You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is a summary of episode 25, which is also the third episode in our discussion of the Journal of Management Studies Classics. This one was about a paper by Porak, Thomas, and Baden-Fuller from 1989 called Competitive Groups as Cognitive Communities, the Case of Scottish Knitwear Manufacturers. For this episode, we were joined by the wonderful Professor Sarah Kaplan, who wrote one of the commentary papers within this classic series. In this summary, I'm going to talk about the work itself, as well as some of the things we discussed during the episode, which you should definitely go and listen to because Sarah was just an amazing guest and an absolute pleasure to speak to. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Brighton in the United Kingdom. Alright, so the paper itself by Porak, Thomas, and Baden-Fuller proved to be an important contributor to the movement towards acknowledging the role of cognition in shaping strategic outcomes and other organizational processes. During the episode, we discussed how, at the time of the publication, a lot of the research on strategy and thinking on strategy was primarily focused on the work of Michael Porter, the one with the Porter's Diamond and the Porter's Five Forces, which essentially emphasized analysis over anything else in determining strategic decisions. So if you go by Porter, then the idea is to analyze the market until any important insights can be derived. Now, this kind of thinking doesn't take into account individual factors or individual interpretations of the environment, which is where Porak, Thomas, and Baden-Fuller came in. They showed in their analysis of Scottish knitwear firms that rivalry was a cognitive construction based on the set of firms identified by managers and competitors. Their work broke with this idea of Porterian analysis by suggesting that categorization, so categories of competitors, played an important role in competition and that environment in which operations were conducted by these companies were subject to interpretations and actions of managers in the companies themselves. In essence, this work also builds on contingency theory by Lawrence and Lorsch, which we discussed in episode 16, which essentially emphasized that managers need to figure out what the environment of their companies is, and then they need to adjust their business operations to those environments. So, looking at how business fits with the environment. And the idea is that if the fit is good, then the business becomes sustainable. A good way of thinking about this is through an analogy of choosing what to wear. According to Porter and contingency theory, the way you would decide on which garment to select would be by analyzing the weather, objectively deriving what it's like, whether it's warm or cold, and then selecting the appropriate garment. Now, we all know that that's not how it works, and that the interpretation of whether it's warm or cold is largely subject to individuals, and what one might find warm, the other one might find not as warm. And that's kind of like what Porak, Thomas, and Baden-Fuller bring to the table. They emphasize the role of interpretation, that deciding on whether it's warm or cold is largely subject to individuals' cognitive constructs. So whether we feel warm or cold, and thus which garment we select for the kind of weather that we interpret there to be. Now, this isn't always correct, obviously, but that's how it works. It's not an objective analysis, but rather an interpretation of what is the environment of the firm that determines how the firm would be operated by managers, not an analysis of the environment and then the fitting of the firm to that environment or technology, as would be the case with the work of John Woodward, which we might look at in season 4 at some point. So how did they do it? Essentially, they looked at 17 firms within the Scottish knitwear industry and using a method to elicit what they called cognitive taxonomies of the industry, they found that the managers they interviewed had a hierarchical categorization of their competitive environment, which basically means that starting broadly with textiles as an industry and then narrowing it down to knitwear, then full fashion classics, and finally high quality garments and so on and so forth. So they found that most managers thought only of other Scottish knitwear manufacturers as their competition, as opposed to people producing similar products elsewhere in Europe or in the world. Indeed, firms from other parts of Britain were omitted as well, because they were seen as being a different business or only kind of a competitor. Based on this, the authors concluded that the set of beliefs about which firms are capable of producing certain types of sweater defined the strategic group, because managers in these manufacturing organizations only saw these related firms as potentially posing competitive threats. They further argued that the definition of competitive group was self-reinforcing, because the managers drew on data from a fairly limited set of sources. We discussed this during the episode, where we had a bit of a back and forth with Sarah about whether this can be understood as an oligopolistic relationship or a what I suggested to be a sort of cognitive aristocracy, where a set of large but few manufacturers can shape the perception of industry in a disproportionate way. In any case, the managers of the companies in the research tended not to do systematic market research of any kind, but instead consulted their existing peers, agents, design consultants, and other people within their general environment. As a result, their own network acted as an information filter by narrowing the range of market data and other information that would be coming in. In essence, they generated a sort of echo that they kept listening to by not bringing in any outside influences or information or any stuff like that. Not only this, but they also had causal beliefs about customers, competitors, suppliers, and retailers that influenced their general strategy. So, for example, with customers, that they thought that their customers are the top 5% of wage earners, and they would be unaffected by the economic ebb and flow. Then with regards to competitors, they thought that, for instance, that Scottish companies are not good at designing fashion, or that their suppliers are the finest in the world, and so on and so forth. And these beliefs, not necessarily backed by any fact or research, in essence were associated with a set of actions, such as buying from certain people or selling to certain retailers, and targeting certain segments of customers, which thus coagulated into a strategy and strategic choices. Now, potentially the most important idea that emerged from this work is the analysis involved the connection between competitive groups and individual firm strategic behavior, so the stuff that I just talked about. The authors suggested that the link between group-level and firm-level dynamics is the shared mental model of strategy makers, or more commonly managers. So linking group behavior and firm behavior is essentially done within the interpretative behavior of managers. Now, authors also argued that such mental models are the basis of coordinated behavior in some competitive settings. So kind of going to a higher level now. And they refer to this as cognitive oligopolies. And these cognitive oligopolies exist because competitors define each other as competitors. And while this sounds as a tautology of sorts, that is one of the key findings of this paper, that in order to shape the strategic landscape, managers need to understand who their competitors are. And the way they understand who their competitors are is essentially by defining that. So this isn't something that comes from the outside or something that is determined by the environment necessarily, or at least not in the way that was suggested by Michael Porter or Lawrence and Lorsch, but it's something that is self-imposed and self-determined by managers subject to their information environments. Managers do this in part also because of their cognitive limits, which create a need to define a competitive set that identifies a small enough number of firms to be monitored. If you think back to the Carnegie Mellon work on bounded rationality, this is a direct link to that. And we discussed Carnegie Mellon in a special series that we have that you can go and check out on our website. But coming back to this work, what is powerful about this argument of cognitive oligopolies is that it reverses the causality proposed by economists, which was prevalent at the time. And the causality that is proposed by economists essentially suggests that the arrangement of companies and the arrangement of industry is what creates the cognitive oligopoly. Whereas Porach and co. suggest that it's the other way around, that it's the cognitive oligopolies that create coordination and inter-firm monitoring. In essence, their model that they espouse in this work, it endogenizes rivalry rather than treating it as just something external and to be considered as yet another variable. But more generally, the paper is primarily should be seen as a contribution to a growing literature that placed cognitive dynamics and the individuality of managers at the center of strategy formulation and strategic outcomes, rather than as subservient elements to it. I think it may be worth mentioning the way by which this interpretation happens. Essentially, in the paper, the authors present a three-stage sequence, which goes from objective to subjective back to objective. And what this refers to is that managers see their environment as objective. There is no premises here that the way they interpret their competitors or the business environment or customers or suppliers or anything like that has to do with any degree of relativity or kind of definitional variability. So seeing their environment as objective, as out there, and objective of course also means passive, they interpret it, make sense of it, attach meanings and values that are relevant to their particular occupation and mode of activity. Now, based on these meanings, they construct plans and act upon those plans, which in turn structures the environment and objectivizes their interpretations, so the interpretations of managers. This is a type of a processual approach to organizational analysis, and it very much resembles a structuration theory by Giddens, which is something that Sarah brought up during the episode. More importantly, however, it highlights the seamless transition that these managers enact in their environment without necessarily realizing that their actions are shaping their competitive landscape. They are, through their definitions and their cognitive oligopolies, in essence determining their own context of the business that they're doing. And this is very important when it comes to such issues as informational myopia, which is something that Tom brought up during the episode, one of our new podcasters, where companies become so enclosed in this cognitive oligopoly or cognitive community that they desensitize themselves to new inputs of information and thus essentially come crashing down a hill. And we talked about this invoking by now classic talking about organizations examples of Nokia and iPhone and all those companies that also like BlackBerry that succumbed to this informational myopia. Further in relation to this, we discussed how various communities can be formed and to what extent organizations are embedded in their social community. So in the case of Scottish knitwear manufacturers, they were very much embedded within their villages and towns that produced this type of garments. And Tom also brought up an example of when a particular food or drink is trademark in such a way that it can only be produced within a particular region. So thinking of things like champagne that can only be produced within the Champagne region. We then discussed some aspects related to the definition of categories. That was at the beginning of part two of the episode. And we talked about the methodological importance of understanding studies within the context of the time that they were presented in. So this happens a lot in this podcast when we talk about early authors and then we try to discuss how they were bringing in the human factor into management and organizations. And Sarah emphasized that this also applies to work published within our living memory, such as this paper by Porak, Thomas, and Baden-Fuller, that it needs to be understood in the context that it was presented in, which was a very functionalist, economics-driven approach where structure and technology took precedence over anything that had to do not only with human, but especially with the cognitive, and that, of course, is in relation to strategy. So I think that's probably good for the summary, and I hope that this gave you enough information about the paper and the concepts that we discussed during episode 25 to go back and listen to it. There's some audio quality issues, but that had to do with the recording process, and yeah, so we apologize for that. But still, you can hear Sarah very well, and she mainly does the talking there. So it's a great episode. Go and listen to her and learn about this very important aspect of strategic management research, courtesy of the Journal of Management Studies. Next week, we are going to discuss a paper by Carl Weick on enacted sense-making. This will be very similar to the episode where we did a few months ago, episode 20, where we were joined by a retired US Navy Admiral, Tom Mercer. So I would suggest you go and check that out, revisit that, before continuing on to episode 26, which is bound to be very interesting as well. Also, a reminder that we have a newsletter, and people are signing up, and it's great. We're really excited to be publishing that and sharing some news and things, and as well as events and some interesting things that our social media person, Yusuf, is coming up with. So if you're interested in enacted sense-making and how people essentially interpret their environment as a follow-up on this particular work, please join us next week as we discuss a paper by Carl Weick from 1988, Enacted Sense-Making in Crisis Situations, here on Talking About Organizations.